It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, political satirist Bassem Youssef shares the serious side of comedy. First, House Republicans released a new tax plan this morning, the most sweeping rewrite of the tax code in decades. Henry Aaron is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution here to provide some analysis. Hank, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Well, what stuck out to you the most from this new tax proposal?
Well, not a lot of surprises. One of the things that stood out was the presence of gimmicks. The budget resolution limits the amount of revenue that the tax bill can lose to $1.5 trillion. Just as an aside, cutting taxes at a time when the nation faces deficits that are projected to grow seems to be a little unusual, to put it mildly. But they have to stay within $1.5 billion,
and they want to cut
tax rates a great deal. So in order to do that, there are a variety of provisions that phase out or take effect only after a while. One example is that the estate tax, which is currently allows couples to have estates of about $11 million or more and have them not be taxed. That ceiling would go up to $22 million, which loses some revenue. But then late in the 10-year budget window, the tax begins to go away entirely. There's a provision that allows businesses to deduct all costs of purchase of equipment, but only for 5 or 6 years, and then the deductions come back again. Of course, it's likely that at that point, Congress would be under tremendous pressure to continue those provisions. That would lose more revenue, and there isn't room for that revenue loss within the budget window. There's a claim that the reduction in the number of tax brackets would simplify income tax filing. That really isn't true, because most of us simply look at a table in the tax forms or use something on a computer to calculate taxes. That doesn't simplify things really at all. There's an increase in the standard deduction, a very large increase. That would simplify tax filing because it would reduce the number of people who need to itemize.
And Hank, that $1.5 trillion revenue limit or revenue loss limit, as I understand it, that's a little bit procedural. That's what they need to do to make it so the Senate can pass this without a 60-vote majority. Do I have that right?
It's not the $1.5 trillion specifically. What is needed is that the Congress pass so-called budget resolution with instructions on what the committees are supposed to do in order to comply with that resolution. If the committees fail to comply with those instructions, then there can be one bill that is put before Congress that isn't subject to a filibuster. If they went over that amount, then the Democrats could filibuster in the Senate. That would mean 60 votes are necessary to pass it, and with 47 Democrats and one independent, that would be unlikely.
I want to key in on a couple other points. The mortgage interest deduction, it would be capped not for current homeowners, but for future home buyers. What kind of impact would that have?
Well, at $500,000, as opposed to the $1 million limit that applies under current law, more people would be subject to tax on would not be able to take a deduction for mortgage payments than the current limit imposes. That would have some effect on home prices at the high end of the home price scale. For the great majority of home buyers outside of the very high-priced areas on the coasts and in large cities, it probably wouldn't mean a whole lot in terms of the housing market. But if you're wealthy and you want to buy a big house or you want to have two or three, that limit would bite.
And a lot of people have pointed out this mortgage interest deduction is supposed to help middle-class people buy houses, but a lot of the people who would be affected don't itemize, so they don't get to take advantage of that deduction. Is this something that disproportionately has helped people at the top end of the income spectrum?
Most itemizers in general are in the upper ranges of the income distribution. If you're down in the $50,000, $60,000 range, it's quite your gross income, it's quite likely you're going to take the standard deduction. So you need to get up to higher incomes with more deductions before it really you run into a lot of people itemizing.
We're talking to Henry Aaron from the Brookings Institution, looking at the House Republican tax plan revealed earlier today. And Hank, let's talk about the 401k changes had been floated by House Republicans, limiting how much people can contribute to their 401k retirement plans. It looks like those caps are not in this plan. Is that right?
There are no changes that I've seen announced for this tax plan with respect to 401ks. But it's important to recognize that the way that debate was reported was very misleading. Under the plan that was being floated, you still would be able to set aside the same amount of money in accounts that are tax-favored. You would have had to do it through so-called Roth IRAs, where you get the tax breaks later rather than right at the front end, rather than regular IRAs or 401ks, where you get to take the deduction right away. But mainly that was a gimmick, a device to get you to pay taxes earlier that you otherwise would have paid later. It wouldn't have imposed additional taxes over the life of a 401k or an IRA. It was just a way of getting money up front that you could use to pay to offset permanent reductions in other tax provisions.
Another question people have been watching for here involved state and local taxes and how people can claim them on their federal taxes. How did that end up shaking out here?
I think the deductions for income taxes go, the deductions for sales taxes go, and there's a limit on the amount of allowed property tax deductions, but most of those would still be permitted.
Now, you mentioned at the outset the deficit. We've got the annual deficit, a growing national debt. How do you see, from what you've seen of this plan so far, I'm sure people are still breaking it down, how do you see the overall impact on federal debt?
The answer to that question is it's like asking what one blade of a scissors can cut. You've got to look at what the impact of the tax this tax bill would be on the subsequent debate over how much we can afford to spend across the range of the federal government. By reducing revenues in a deficit situation, you increase the pressure to cut spending elsewhere. And the Republican majority has made crystal clear that it wants to cut spending a lot. So to know what the impact is going to be on the overall deficit, you need to see the expenditure side of their program, which they have been quite clear about. It calls for massive reductions in Medicaid, substantial reductions in Medicare, curtailments of other domestic spending, still a sizable deficit would remain. So down the road, I would predict there would be very strong pressures to curtail Social Security, something that nobody has surfaced yet for public debate, but that, in my view, is a clear consequence of reducing the revenues available to support federal spending.
There is the supply-side argument that by cutting the taxes, lowering corporate taxes as well, we're going to generate an economic boost that will end up making up in revenues. The increased economic activity makes up in revenues what we lose in those percentages. How do you see that analysis?
I don't think economic analysis supports it, notwithstanding some assertions that have come out of the Council of Economic Advisors. We do know from history that there are conditions in which cutting taxes does spur growth and can go a long way toward that growth can go a long way toward paying for the tax cuts. But that occurs only when the economy is operating well below economic capacity, when we're in recessions, and the tax cuts spur demand so that we get back faster to something approaching full employment. Right now, we're at very close to full employment. There isn't room on additional labor supply, and there's no reason to think that businesses that are now sitting on trillions of dollars of cash that they can use to support investment are going to suddenly decide that it is worth spending those dollars because there's been a cut in future corporate tax rates.
We'll leave it there. Hank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Henry Aaron is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He joined us for a look at the new federal tax plan from House Republicans. In the midst of the Arab Spring, Bassam Youssef rose to TV stardom. He started making satirical YouTube videos in his apartment's laundry room and eventually became the star of Egypt's most-watched TV show. But after poking fun at Egypt's leaders from Hosni Mubarak to Mohamed Morsi to the current president, al-Sisi, the government decided they didn't want him to do it anymore. Youssef fled Egypt. He's since become an international figure. Here he is on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Is there anything familiar about Donald Trump to
other
you?
Than being orange?
Yes.
Yes. I think he reminds people like me who come here and stay in America, they're like homesick for dictatorship, and he provides that.
Bassam Youssef is currently on tour. He's doing a public event at UW-Madison on November 8th. He joins us now. Bassam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, how are you guys?
Well, good. And I want to start kind of at the beginning of your media career. Here you are. You were this doctor making satirical YouTube videos in your laundry room, then a TV show. And then why do you think your program got so much attention so quickly in Egypt?
Because we did something that I think it was needed for a very long time. For 60 years, the only kind of satire that was allowed was social satire. It was people found it refreshing when they found someone making fun of authority, making fun of the people who have been brainwashing them and, lying to them right in their face, instead of just like making the very safe, predictable kind of comedy of everyday social comedy. And so it's kind of like as if it almost struck a nerve, you know? And I think this is why it was very well received in the beginning. And it was very controversial, too, because people started to say, well, are we allowed to use profanity? Are we allowed to speak against everything that we consider sacred and untouchable? So satire in itself is a pretty much an offensive art. And it was watched by everybody, those who liked it and those who didn't.
And it put you in legal peril. I mean, you couldn't make fun of a particular leader's hat without potentially getting into legal trouble, right?
Yeah, that was under the Muslim Brotherhood. But also after the Muslim Brotherhood, what happened that I was not allowed to make fun of the ridiculous claims that were made by the military. So basically, the military and the Muslim Brotherhood, they don't like me that much.
Is there something about a dictatorship and authoritarian government that's inherently absurd that cries out for political satire?
Oh, absolutely. Anybody who comes and he believes that he is the best out there, he is the greatest, the best, the all-knowing, it just invites satire. And this is why those people, those authoritarian leaders, are the most sensitive to satire, because it kind of undermines this fake image that they project for themselves. And this is why the first targets of any authoritarian regimes are comedians, satirists, and stand-up comedians, cartoonists.
You went through the Arab Spring, this wave of hope, not just in Egypt, but in a number of other countries as well, only to end up, as you say, under Muslim Brotherhood rule, and then military authoritarian dictatorship again. I mean, that's a massive crushing of hope. How do you still find something funny in that?
Well, there's always something funny about how dictators take themselves too seriously. There was a brief moment of hope, a period of hope, 3 years, that we thought that things would be different. Yeah, but even as our hopes were crushed, we always find the humor of how massive groups of people were being brainwashed and believed fake news. I mean, fake news is always a great material to make fun of. And this is what we were doing in our show, and this is where we were find humor, and basically we went out laughing.
You were ultimately forced to flee Egypt. What was that decision like for you to come here to the United States?
Well, I was very conflicted about that, but that was my only option to leave the country because it was not safe anymore. I didn't want to wake up and find myself either banned from traveling or, I don't know, under some sort of an arrest. So leaving, I didn't have any choice about like leaving or staying. But the fact coming here in America and starting to reinvent and recreate your career again, the different language, different audience, all from scratch, that was a little bit daunting and terrifying, still is. Still trying to build my career here, and I hope I make it.
And you are here in the United States. You've got this unique perspective. What do you find funny and absurd about American politics now?
Do you really need
where
to
do you,
ask this
Where
question?
Do you want to start?
Where can you start? Where do you stop? I mean, it's kind of like the funniest thing is like it's as if Donald Trump would like to have the unlimited powers of a Middle Eastern dictator, and he's kind of like feeling envy that he can't. So he's trying to operate with whatever tools he has.
We are pretty quick, I think, in the United States to raise the specter of tyranny in our country. People accused President Obama of being an authoritarian dictator. Now people raising concerns about President Trump coming from dictatorships. What do you think when you hear that here in the United States?
I think people consider anything that is against their beliefs and their political leaning as a kind of a dictatorship. So it's kind of like it's dictatorship unless he's on my side, so I can accept that.
What kind of parallels or differences do you see here in the United States versus Egypt? And I know you're watching the whole world and how things are going now. What comparisons do you make?
Well, how people can believe ridiculous things in order to strengthen their own beliefs, how people are willing to give up reason and ignore logic in order to believe things or narratives or political messages as long as it fits with their own belief system. I think it's more of a human thing, not just like an American or Middle Eastern thing.
Does political satire have the potential to burst that bubble, to shake us out of our ridiculous beliefs sometimes?
Only if you are willing to. I mean, people would need to be willing to listen. If you're not willing to listen, not political satire, not anything will change your mind. Because many of the liberal circles like celebrate the late night comedians and how they're changing the narrative. They're not. I mean, do you think those people who on the other side of the spectrum listen to them? No, I don't think so.
So how do you reach out? How do you get a message to those people who disagree, who won't find the parody funny?
Well, maybe you can't. I think people are just like putting too much pressure on satire and comedy. It's not a magic pill. You would reach people who are willing to listen. If people don't will to listen, there's nothing really you can do.
I want to look at a project you're working on here in the United States now. I understand you're developing a new TV comedy with Larry Wilmore. It's about a Middle Eastern superhero family. This is for ABC. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's still in development. We're still working on the pilot, and it's too early. I'm going to celebrate when it's green-lighted into series. So it's we're just very early in the project. But I really hope that like we make it, because that will make a ton of difference for me, for people like me, for kind of like having our own foothold in and own footprint into the media field in America. And you know, it's gonna be refreshing to see Arabs in shows other than Homeland.
Yeah, and we love our superheroes here in the United States. And I understand at least the premise here is that the parents of this family, they're superheroes, but they have to be secret about it because superheroes are illegal. Can you talk about this superhero metaphor for immigrants, especially from the Middle East?
Yeah, well, there's like repercussions for like doing for what we call supering. It's still really in development, but you know, having a superhero family that are Middle Eastern would be pretty cool, right?
And now you've gone around the United States over the last couple of years. You've gone to political rallies and gun shows and things like that. First of all, how do you feel as someone from the Middle East in settings where people, at least in the abstract, may not be fond of people in the United States from the Middle East?
I find it challenging. I mean, I don't look as a typical Middle Eastern. I have like blue eyes, and I don't have like that scary beard that they all think that all Muslims are. So it sometimes it's nice to be like a fly on the wall while listening to them like dissing us while I'm sitting there and smiling.
Now, you're living here in the United States. In effect, you're in exile from Egypt. You're starting over. Are you still looking back at Egypt and hoping the day will come when you can go back there and pick up where you left off?
Maybe. I mean, I don't think that much about that. I think right now about what I'm doing here, what my career is going to be like, and what change I can do where I'm living here right now. I have my one-man show that I take around. I'm going to be in Madison soon on the 8th of November. And I have a book out called Revolution for Dummies. It's on Amazon. The paperback is going to come soon in December. And I'm promoting Tickling Giants, hopefully for an Oscar nomination. And there's this pilot I'm working on.
All right, well, good luck with all of that. Bassem, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Bassem Youssef is a political satirist who's been dubbed the Jon Stewart of Egypt. He joined us ahead of his event in Madison at the Wisconsin Union Theater on November 8th. To get direction on complicated political issues, the government often turns to an expert in a field. Whether it's serving in a cabinet position or on an advisory board, those with expertise can have a lot of sway on policy decisions. Our next guest says giving too much power to experts is actually undemocratic, and it can make everyday people feel alienated from their government. He calls for more opportunities to get people involved in making the decisions that affect their lives. Nicholas Tampio is an associate professor of political science at Fordham University in New York. He studies the history of political thought, contemporary political theory, and education policy. His piece in Eon Magazine online is titled "Treat People as Citizens." Nicholas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
I want to start talking about the role of experts, and you introduced me to a new word, new to me, in your piece called epistocracy. What is that? Rule by experts, I guess, right?
Yes. Well, it's a concept coined by Jason Brennan at Georgetown University. He has a recent book called Against Democracy. But the idea goes back to Plato's Republic. And, you know, if you've read Plato's Republic, you'll know that the ideal republic is you have philosophers for kings in charge, you have guardians leading and auxiliaries below them, soldiers and farmers and merchants below them. And so it's very much a system where you put smart people in charge of the whole political order. And that idea has never gone away in Western political thought, but it got a boost in the early 20th century with this journalist named Walter Lippmann. And Walter Lippmann wrote a book called Public Opinion in 1920, which is a devastating attack on democratic politics. And his main line of attack is just saying most people don't know anything about politics. They don't have the time, they don't have the training, they don't have the concentration span. And so, you know, the notion that the people should have power is either nonsensical or dangerous. And I wrote my piece in Eon because a whole new wave of political scientists, economists, social scientists are reviving this argument. And they're using new words and new frames, new evidence, but the backbone of the argument goes back to Lippmann and Plato's Republic. And, you know, what I really want to do is just remind people why democracy is better than rule by experts.
And you write that in that new wave, there's this idea that we can use big data, a benevolent government with smart experts can give us nudges, not overtly push us in certain directions, but, you know, give us little incentives that help us make the right decisions for ourselves. How do you see that taking shape?
Yeah, well, so big data is transforming all sorts of different fields of inquiry and the notion, or all sorts of different aspects of social life. And the notion of nudging is that experts in the background can manipulate preferences so that people supposedly do the right thing. So, you know, a famous example is when you get a job, you're automatically enrolled in a healthcare plan. So you're free to opt out of it. And sometimes you have to pay a fee, but the system is designed to, you know, slot you into the good direction. And so somebody like that is Cass Sunstein, who was the head of the OMB during the Obama administration, or Richard Thaler, who was just awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics. They're big into nudging. And, you know, part of what I'm trying to do in my piece is remind readers the purpose of democracy is not to make the people comfortable. It's not even necessarily to give them good outcomes. The purpose of democracy is to have people connected to their common way of life. And so it has all sorts of benefits. One, it just makes citizens smarter and more informed and more capable of speaking and articulating. So there's this notion that participating in politics educates you to just be a better person. And then there's also the question of you want a connection to the world in which you live, because if you don't, you're alienated and you just feel like these hotshots and or these brainiacs in Washington, D.C. are making all of the decisions. They don't care what you think. And, you know, if they don't care what you think and there's a celebrity on TV saying, you know, he'll speak for you, the silent majority, well, you know, you might be drawn to this charismatic figure. So, you know, I want to remind people that the choice doesn't have to be between epistocrats and populists. It doesn't have to be between very smart, educated people and strong men claiming to speak for the silent majority. There's this third option, which is people participating in politics on a regular basis.
Talking to Nicholas Tapio from Fordham University in New York, he's making the case for more citizen involvement, less reliance on experts in the way we run our government, federal and local, Nicholas. And I think, you know, that suspicion of the everyday person. I think of myself, you know, I'm a resident of a city. I don't know about the finer points of municipal bonding or sanitation management. I don't want me in charge of our wastewater system. Why should people count on me to be part of a decision like that, that I don't come in really knowing anything about?
Sure. That's so the thinking is in the modern world, you need experts. And so the question I'm interested in, what's the relationship between experts and ordinary people? And I realize it's a problematic distinction, but, you know, to stick with your example, somebody who knows a lot about water and waste and has that specialized training, and other people who don't, who are, you know, busy with other things. And one of the insights that I want to bring back into the conversation goes back to Thomas Jefferson, Alexis de Tocqueville, Carol Pateman, and they say, whenever there's an opportunity for people to be involved, you should try to get the people involved, right? So there's this temptation to just say, let's just put the experts in charge of everything and not bother people. And well, one thing is it becomes a vicious circle, right? Because why should people study waste management if their opinion doesn't matter at all? Why should people be involved with schools if their opinion doesn't matter at all? And maybe I can just explain one of the key examples for me.
Sure.
I think we're living in a moment where the federal government is really taking over more and more of the responsibilities for education. And that used to be almost an exclusively local thing. And it really wasn't until 1965, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, that you really saw this escalation of state departments of education and federal U.S. Department of Education after 1979, after it became a department level and or cabinet level. And you know, that trend is just going to keep moving forwards. And I am really grieving the loss of powerful school boards. I think that's one of the when historians look back at the past 50, 60 years and they're trying to make sense of American politics, you've really seen the marginalization of school boards. And for me, those are one of the great sites of democratic activity. And when you've got so-called experts in Washington, D.C. and the nation and state capitals making all the decisions, parents are checking out of schools. They're like, who cares? Why am I gonna participate in the schools? And then they also don't want to participate in politics in general because they haven't gotten in the habit of participating.
Mentioning that year, 1965, makes me wonder what happens if that local empowered school board makes a decision to really heavily segregate their school district. That's part of why in education, the state and federal governments got more involved. Could this lead us at the local level in some cases down a bad path?
So maybe I can use this opportunity to pitch my book that I'm publishing in the spring of 2018 about the Common Core. And I have a chapter almost exclusively on that particular question. And I guess what I would say is too many people still think about education politics as if it's 1954, with Brown versus Board of Education, or 1965. And whereas people pose to me like, so Nick, do you want to go back in time to the 1950s when, poor and minority children were not educated? I just want to go on the record. I don't want to go back in time. I'm not in favor of segregation. The question that strikes me as the real one is, are we going to have a democratic future or a non-democratic future? And part of what I argue in my book is, listen, people in inner city Detroit, people in inner city Baltimore, people in inner city Chicago, they want a say in their children's education. And so education reformers who claim to be speaking for these people, they're not listening to the communities that actually want a meaningful say in how their children are educated. So for my view is that local control should be something in the suburbs, but it also should be in Title I schools or in historically disadvantaged communities.
So on a practical level, how would you recommend a school board or a local government, for that matter, start to maybe shake out of the old habits of not having citizens directly involved and start to reach out and actually listen?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, part of what you need to do is just convince people that it's their right and responsibility to speak up. And so I'm in New York and we've got this really vibrant test refusal movement. And so that's actually been a wonderful activity to see democracy in action, because New York had very little say, or other states had very little say, about the Race to the Top program, or even, I would argue, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act reauthorization, the Every Student Succeeds Act. These were done in the nation's capital, in boardrooms of billionaires' foundations, in state capitals. The test refusal movement is a way to say, hey, listen, we're not happy. The shoe doesn't fit. You might have thought you came up with these great plans, this really good shoe, but we're telling you the shoe doesn't fit. And so, however school boards, however state departments of education, however parents, however journalists can speak up and practice citizenship, that's one way to get the ball rolling.
We're talking to Nicholas Tampio, an associate professor of political science at Fordham University, looking at the role of experts in democracy and why he thinks everyday people need more of a voice. And the more of a voice they have, the more informed they'll be. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that we in the United States rely too much on experts when it comes to policymaking? Do you worry that we've gotten less democratic, less representative of the will of the people? Do you personally feel alienated from the workings of government at the federal, state, or local level? Do you have an example where you think people are doing things differently for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation now with Nicholas Tapio, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University. His piece on Eon is titled "Treat People as Citizens." He calls for everyday people, not experts, to steer democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that we rely too much on policymakers, policy experts, citizens are not involved in the process enough? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a very odd kind of question, but with more of the local governing being moved from the local municipalities, they don't have as much governance ability in the way of how the laws are being shifted and changed to be more county, but then more state regulation. So the locality, the local municipality boards and things are losing a lot of their governance power. So how do people fight that, being trying to get more involved in something other than their local need positions and volunteering and things, but actually getting into fighting back where they're just losing clout?
Gail, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, if say the state is taking power away from my local government, why do I show up at the local town meeting, Nicholas?
So part of what I want to do with my work is just first give people confidence about why the local level matters. And I want to go back to the notion of Thomas Jefferson with these ward republics, with communities that make as many important decisions as possible, acknowledging that sometimes you need state and federal and sometimes international organizations, but as much as you can to have it local. And you know, I can't answer the specifics about that particular area because, you know, you need to figure out where in your circumstances you can move or push back. But one thing I would just tell people is recognize the wisdom of Federalist 51, which said the founders designed the Constitution for ambition to counteract ambition. That I would like to see more people at the local level having the confidence to fight back and actually fight back. So I don't know, you know, I don't know the specifics of your case, of this case, but you know, I mean, things you can see like in New York are sometimes people write resolutions, local school boards write resolutions pushing back against the State Department of Education. So I don't know if there's something that's similar that could happen in Wisconsin where, you know, you just talk to people and you say, listen, we don't just simply have to follow orders from above. The Constitution was designed to give us some powers to raise our voice. Let's raise our voice.
Gail, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Paul in Lincoln County. Paul, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Interesting conversation, interesting guest. I am 71 years old. I'm living on a wooded portion of what was the small family farm I grew up on, northwest of Merrill. I'm also a county board supervisor, one of 22 in a county that has a population of just under 30,000 people. And I realize from my county board experience that there are times when we need to consult and listen to the experts in various areas of county governance. And that's crucial, and that needs to happen. On the other hand, I'm old enough. I said I was 71. When I grew up, there were lots of little farms out in this rural area, and now there are none that are functioning. And when I was also a child, there were two one-room schools out here, both of which died as the small farms died. So my point here is that one also has to think of the demoralization that happens when the rural culture of small farms is destroyed, essentially, and consolidation occurs. And with that consolidation, as education moves to the city, as it has out here, the rural folks are left with a kind of a sense of alienation and resentment.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring in our guest because you brought up a lot of points there. Paul saying, you know, we lost our local small schools are consolidated into bigger districts. It's further away and metaphorically and literally more distant to the people who rely on it, Nicholas.
Yes. Well, I don't think you can look at any of these issues in isolation from one another. I don't think you can look at it economics or, you know, these political questions aside from economic questions, aside from intellectual questions. So, you know, we have to be active on many fronts. I'm sad to hear about the absence of local farms. You know, that was a great American tradition, and I'm sad that it's no longer as vibrant as it once was. In the progressive era, there was this massive consolidation of school districts, and you know, that argument is proceeding apace. There's an argument by this guy, Mark Tucker, from the National Center of Education and the Economy, that our country should have 70 school boards, which would just be going even farther in the direction of consolidation. If you, there's this woman who directs the Learning Policy Institute, Linda Darling Hammond, and she's in favor of a national ministry of education, right? So even going more in the direction of consolidation. You know, we have to go back to our tradition of an American political thought that says, listen, our country is unique among other countries in the world because we entrust ordinary people, because we empower teachers and principals and parents and children to run the school. So, you know, I'm not saying we have the wind in our back at this precise historical moment, but, you know, I think at the minimum we need to get clear that, like, listen, democracy is something worth fighting for. There's something valuable lost when we let so-called experts proceed independently of the will of the people.
Are we talking about here, in some cases, the process, Nicholas, is more important than the outcome? That, you know, sometimes we have to put up with a decision that we might not find admirable because that the process in and of itself is more valuable?
Yeah, that's right. Because so I have a certain philosophy of how I would like my local school to be run, right? I myself like the John Dewey hands-on inquiry-based model. I have friends who like the more traditionalist model of let's read the classics and let's do the memorization and let's have a maybe in some cases even more religiously grounded education. So here's the choice. You can either just try to say, I want one model of education for the entire country, or you can say, listen, we're a big country and the Constitution doesn't enumerate education as a power. Let's let these debates take place all across the country. And, you know, the fact is you're going to have parents involved, teachers, superintendents. There's going to be yelling at meetings. There's going to be a lot of ill will. But you know what? That's okay, because you've got parents involved. And when you have parents involved, education's better. Community life is better. That's my view.
And Nicholas, briefly, as we wrap up, we argue right now about a lot of things in the country. What you're talking about doesn't seem to be at the top of the agenda. Are people listening to what you're talking about, trying to bring our government back to citizens and the local level?
I don't think I could have my energy unless I felt like enough people were listening. And, you know, in New York, I'll just stick to the example that's close to home. We've got this very vibrant test refusal movement, and parents are upset about what's happening, and this is an occasion where democracy is not an abstract concern, where it's actually, hey, listen, this is my kids, right? This is something that matters to me, and now I understand the purpose of democracy. Maybe our country made a mistake by placing too much trust on experts. So, I'm not going to say democracy is a raging fire in America in 2017. But it's still there, and I think we need to do everything we can to preserve it and maybe even make it a little bit more democratic.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Nicholas Tampio. He's an associate professor of political science at Fordham University. He's with us to talk about why he thinks relying too much on experts for political decisions is bad. We should be more democratic and trust citizens with more responsibility. Some big news from the pyramids of Egypt. In the Great Pyramid of Giza, there's another room we didn't know about. Scientists using subatomic particles detected the previously hidden room, and it's a big one. Judith Sears-Poisson has been in there, in the pyramid, that not the secret room.
Well,
right, Judith?
As far as I know, not, but, you know, you don't see a whole lot when
you
you're
did
in
fall
there.
Through that trap door and had that series
of
adventures.
Yeah, I was all by myself. No, it's amazing. Actually, Egypt was the first place that I ever traveled outside the U.S. many, many years ago, back in 1985, and the pyramid is incredible, and you almost have to crawl in through these tunnels, and then they take you into rooms, and then they turn out the lights to scare everybody. But, I mean, it's a huge structure, but what they're talking about, this new room, this chamber that they think they found, is thought to be 30 meters long. That's from the end zone to the 32-yard line, and as tall as two to three-story building. So it's huge.
That's huge. And I guess they're being kind of cautious. You know, a lot of people thinking secret room full of treasure. This is where the real stuff is. And they're like, whoa, whoa, we don't know that.
Yeah, right.
Could be empty.
Could be empty. But I think what's so cool is, you know, this was built about 2,500 years B.C. And, you know, we're still finding out great mysteries. It's the last of the wonders of the ancient world, actually.
You want to go back for another look?
Sure.
With your muon detector?
Yes, with my muon detector.
To find
detector.
All the rest of the secret rooms. Judith, thanks.
Sure.
More coming up here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. We'll